This episode of the 21-5 Show is brought to you by FindAPilot.com, the premier aviation marketplace where pilots can search for jobs and employers can search for pilots. Pilots, head over to FindAPilot.com to create your free account and profile today. And as a special offer to our listeners, FindAPilot.com is offering 21.5% off premium memberships. Just use coupon code 21FIVE. FindAPilot.com has employers covered too. Post a job for just $49 or search through the thousands of pilot profiles in their database for the perfect candidate. FindAPilot.com, where jobs take flight.
Welcome to the 21-5 Show, a podcast for professional pilots by professional pilots. I'm Max, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Dylan. We're both professional pilots with experience with the airlines, business aviation, and flight instruction.
You're on 121.5, the emergency frequency.
Today, we have a little bit of a different episode, something that's important to Dylan and I, and I think hits close to home for all pilots out there. We have an interview with two guys that have lost their medical. One's in the process of getting it back. The other one has gone through the whole process and has his medical reinstated. But it's kind of a series that we're going to be doing with loss of medical, things you can do to prevent it, how to manage it, and then also how to insure yourself financially against a potential loss of medical situation for everybody, for corporate pilots, airline pilots, and car, everything, all guys in between. So first, we're going to hear from a good friend of ours, Clint. Clint works at a major airline, legacy carrier. He's our age, which really made it hit home, being that he's the same age as us and also a close friend of ours from college. And so he's going to tell you his story.
And then someone on Pro Pilot World actually reached out to us to tell his story of losing and actually regaining his medical. So we thought it was important to share these stories. We have learned some crazy statistics. One in 20 professional pilots is going to lose his medical at some point. So I think this really applies to all of us. It's something that you hate to think about, but it's real life.
And that one in 20 isn't just a loss of medical for, because we've had another friend of ours that lost his medical just for a few months.
Several, yeah.
The one in 20 is a long-term medical loss, like over a year.
So it's eye-opening to listen to. I think it's important to think about it, and it's a story that's going to make you think, and there are things that we can do to prevent this and mitigate it. So I think that's really the point of this whole series, right, is to raise awareness and make sure that everyone's protected.
For sure, and it's one of those things you never think about it until it happens to you. So what we're trying to bring to light here is these guys, it's happened to them.
Yeah.
They're going to tell you what they learned, what they could have done better, what they would recommend everybody else do, and I think it'll really make you guys think about this looming thing that's over your head as a professional pilot that nobody ever really thinks about until it happens to them or happens to someone close to them.
This is a two-part series. This episode is going to be focusing on some of the stories. And then in the next episode, we're going to be providing some of the solutions. This is going to be a little bit longer episode than we typically publish, but it was important to get these guys' stories out to you.
We would love your feedback too on the length of the podcast. All of the rest of them have been between what, an hour and a half?
They're like an hour. It's typically around an hour 15. Yeah.
Yeah. So somewhere between there, this one's going to run longer than that, around closer to 2 hours or so, plus or minus. Mm-hmm. So we'd love some feedback to see if you guys, the hardest part we have a lot of times with this podcast is cutting it down to keep it in our time frame of it less than an hour and a half. So if it's something that it runs longer, you guys are okay with, let us know. That'd be very, very helpful. And if it's something we need to keep to less than an hour and a half, that would also be super helpful.
Okay. Let's get on to interview number one with Clint.
All right, everybody. We have a very special guest on the show today. It's Clinton. Clinton is one of Dylan and I's old buddies, of course, from our college days, and we've stayed close ever since.
He meets the criteria for interviews of flying for American Eagle and going to Embry-Riddle. So you're
We call all of our guests gold star. Somehow, even in some we don't even know.
I don't know if I'd call it a criteria or a curse.
We've had guests, Clint, that we didn't know until recently. that started flying at American Eagle. It's weird. It's like all roads end up there somehow. But anyway, we have Clint on the show today. Clint's going to kind of go through his experience with losing his medical and his quest to regain it. Just his story overall, I think, is pretty interesting because Clint's not an older guy, you know, at the end of his end of the road here. Clint's our age. So anyway, Clint, take it away. Go ahead and start at the top and tell us everything.
Like Max and Dylan have said, I started at Embry-Riddle with these two guys a long time ago. After Embry-Riddle, went to American Eagle, spent a very short time there, and then moved on to another regional because things just weren't working out at American Eagle for me. So I went to ExpressJet, and I ended up spending about 8.5 years there. Some good, some bad. Had the opportunity to do a lot of wonderful things there. I was a crew resource management instructor where I was basically in ground school every day, teaching guys crew resource management from new hires to captains to upgrades, but also still able to fly the line. And I did that for about 4 years and then was a captain for out of the 8.5 years, I think I was a captain for 4 of them. And then for 2 of those, I was a check airman there. That all gave me a lot of great experience. From there, I was able to move on to one of the legacy carriers. And I've been there for the last coming up on 6 years. And it's been a great experience. I've had a lot of wonderful things happen there. But at the same time, I had this health issue pop up on me kind of out of nowhere. And when it did, it really opened up my eyes to how bad things can get basically in a 15-minute period. What happened was I was out golfing with a couple of friends of mine and my wife and started noticing I was having a weird feeling in my chest and was having trouble controlling my heart rhythm. And in fact, my heart was beating out of control upwards of 200 to 250 beats a minute. And it just kind of came out of nowhere. And it scared me enough that I decided that I needed to go to the hospital and get checked out.
And Clint, just for context, how old are you?
I am 39 years old. So yeah, and that was something else is this, what I have, and I'll explain that a little bit later, is not something that's an age-based problem. It's actually a hereditary thing. It's something that I was possibly born with, but it just manifested itself on this particular day. So my wife, I told her what was going on. She took me to the hospital. They hooked me up to all the equipment in the emergency room, and they determined that I was going into a heart rhythm called SVT or supraventricular tachycardia, which is a disqualifying thing in the FAA.
So did you self-ground at that point, or what?
I did. Actually, that day I self-grounded.
Okay.
Well, I wasn't that day, but it would have been the next day. I called my company. I told them what was going on. However, you know, I really didn't understand exactly the process that I was going to have to go through, because like I said, it all happened in this really quick window of I'm not feeling good, something's wrong, and then go to the hospital, find out I have this diagnosis. And from there, it didn't really go off the rails, but it just really changed my life in a proverbial heartbeat, I guess you would say.
Clever.
So after getting the diagnosis, and then getting on the internet and reading what needed to be done, I grounded myself the next morning.
So what does that look like? You just call them and say, hey, I have to self ground, and they just start pulling your trips and using sick time. Is that how it works?
Yeah, it was kind of a process because I'm kind of hitting them. Well, I was in a weird place when that happened because I had just finished training on the 787 and I was waiting for operating experience to start. So I didn't have any trips on my schedule, but I had trips coming up on my schedule. So the first thing I actually did was call my chief pilot's office, and they were extremely helpful. They went through the process of what I needed to do, who I needed to call. And from there, I made about probably 10 different phone calls that day to different entities in the company, as well as to insurance companies. Because this occurred on a Sunday. And so Monday morning, I was on the phone basically from the time I woke up to the time I went to bed. And by the end of the day, yeah, I basically had self-grounded myself. Now, I never contacted the FAA in any way, shape, or form. And I never contacted the previous AME, my previous examiner. I still haven't even spoke to him. My union representatives directed me to our Union Medical department, and they did a lot of the legwork for me on calling ahead before I contacted them. And we went through the process of getting me offline, so to speak.
So Clint, I imagine it's a whirlwind that first day when you're making a lot of those phone calls, and from like an emotional standpoint, processing all that, did you even really take time to think about the consequences of what was going on at that point? Or did that kind of sink in a little bit later?
No, it actually sinked in right from the start, because what happened was when I was in the emergency room and they had me hooked up to all of the equipment, the doctors and the nurses were actually pretty happy that they had been able to detect my heart rhythm problem. They were actually able to see what was going on with my heart. And to them, that was a very big deal, because a lot of people go into the hospital with the same type of problems and they can't really determine what's going on with them. Maybe you're having a heart rhythm issue when you decide to go to the hospital, but by the time you get there, it's not happening anymore. But in my case, they were able to see it. And it was a little bit, it was awkward for me, because the medical staff, while they were doing the best they could, they were really excited that they had found my problem. And they're like, oh, it's no big deal. Except they didn't realize that for a pilot, what was going on with me is an extremely big deal. And when I say the word average Joe, I'm not like downplaying anybody's careers or their jobs, but they basically made it sound like, oh yeah, this is no problem. You'll get fixed and you'll go back to work tomorrow. And it's like, yeah, that's not going to be what happens to me.
Yeah.
Or people like me. And so it took a little bit of discussing it with them, how severe this problem was for me from a career standpoint. Now, from a medical standpoint, what I had is something that they can manage and something they can fix. And that's a good thing. But at the same time, it's also very disheartening, because I knew, and my wife knew, that I was in a pretty serious situation for us going forward.
Yeah, I can't imagine the thoughts going through your head in those first 24 hours, and then you having to deal with all of these calls to the company and insurance officials. So what happened after you made those initial calls and grounded yourself?
So our union, the medical side, was extremely helpful. And basically what they told me to do was, don't worry about your career right now, worry about yourself and worry about your health. And so that's what I did. I had to disconnect myself from my career for a period of time and just focus on getting healthy and getting this problem taken care of. So in the first few days after it happened, yeah, I was kind of in shock. And I was put with a cardiologist specialist right away. In fact, I saw her 3 or 4 days after I had the initial arrhythmia problem.
Was this somebody that the aeromedical guys at the union recommended, or was it just someone that was recommended by your doctor, or how did you find the heart doctor?
Well, a couple of different things. Number one, this person was had worked on a friend of mine. So I had spoken with them in the days following the event. And no, to be frank with you, Max, that person did not come from anyone within the company or from any of my insurance or anybody. This was just someone that I kind of randomly selected that I'd heard really good things about. And it was also a recommendation from the ER doctors. So I kind of found her happen chance, and it was kind of a grace of God, I guess you would say, because she is phenomenal. I went into her, we discussed what was going on, and she told me what she could do to help me. And she gave me a number of different options. I mean, obviously she said you can do nothing and just hope that it never happens again. Because at this point, my rhythm was back in normal status, but she gave me different options on what I could and could not do. And one of them was taking medication essentially for the rest of my life, which didn't sound like a viable option for me. And then the other option was to go ahead and go with her procedure that she could do, which was an ablation, where she could go in. So essentially with SVT or any type of arrhythmia, they're able to go into your heart via catheter through your leg, which is what I ended up doing. And they send essentially diodes into your heart, and they're able to determine where the arrhythmia is coming from. And they're able to then ablate that with a laser and take that rhythm or that, I guess you would say, problem rhythm with your heart out. And so that's what I ended up elected to do. So it was kind of a whirlwind, if you guys want to know the truth, because from the day that it happened to the day that I was in surgery was only 13 days.
Oh my gosh, really?
Yeah. So it happened extremely fast, which is a good thing because, and we can discuss that later when we start getting into the medical side of it, because for a pilot, anytime you have a procedure like this done, an ablation, while they're not necessarily a very invasive procedure, it starts a timeline. And that's really what I've been dealing with for the last, you know, at this point, I'm coming up on 75 days since my procedure. And I think that it was a really good thing that I got it done just as fast as possible. So yeah, from the day that it happened to the day that I was on the operating table was 13 days.
That's that much sooner you're going to get your medical back, right? Because you're not wasting all this time between detection of a problem and the remedy, right?
Correct. So anytime you have an ablation done, and there's a lot of different, I'm no expert on all the other heart or any other type of medical issues that you can run into. But for me, in my particular case, doing the ablation starts a 90-day clock. So I had the ablation done on July 8th, and that started a 90-day clock, which essentially, if you go 90 days, that takes us to October 8th. And that's basically all a timeline set up by the FAA. So you have to go through all these different things that the FAA wants you to do between now and then. But really the biggest clock that they start is if you had an ablation done, you have 90 days from that. And then there's other things that you have to do.
Like what? Like a bunch of tests and EKGs and things like that?
Well, yeah, it's a little bit strange because if you read the FAA guidelines for an ablation, for specifically what I had for the supraventricular tachycardia or SVT, it starts a 90-day clock. And then after 90 days, then I have to do a 24-hour Holter monitor, which is where they, you know, they're going to hook diodes up to me and I have to wear a monitor on my body for 24 hours and they're going to measure my heart, my rhythm and make sure everything's good. And if everything comes back good, then the FAA can issue or my AME can request for them to issue my medical back. So that's the biggest thing is the 24-hour Holter monitor. However, when you get into the details of it, and this is where my union came in really big and really helped me a lot, is there's a lot of tests that they want to have done that are not prescribed in the FAA guidelines. So I have coming up in the next week, I have to do a stress test, which is no big deal. I go into my cardiologist and I'll do a stress test with her. I have to have a thyroid test done. I have to have a lipid test done. And all of these things have to be basically submitted to the FAA after 90 days, along with the Holter monitor.
Now, is all that covered under your health insurance? Because you're checking boxes for the FAA, not necessarily what's medically necessary. So is all that still covered?
Yes, it is. That's okay. Been one of the other things that's been good for me is luckily, you know, there's some shortcomings of what my company provides. However, one thing that's been good is my medical coverage, while I had a pretty high deductible, but I've already met that. Just to give you guys an example and just to put everybody else that's maybe not as covered as well as I am, my ablation surgery cost $80,000.
Whoa.
So now for me out of pocket, it wasn't nearly that much because my insurance was pretty well covered, but it's just something for people to keep in mind how expensive these kind of treatments can be, because it was a heck of a lot more than I was expecting. But yes, my insurance has covered everything for the most part. I've had some pretty substantial insurance bills, but luckily I've been able to pay those and I'm up to speed right now. But I know there's a lot of people out there that may not be as lucky as I am or in the position I am. And that's kind of why I'm talking to you guys today. And putting this out there is because there's a lot of stuff that can happen to you and can happen quickly that can really put you in a position that you really don't want to be in.
Yeah, it certainly is eye-opening. And I think the biggest thing, too, is that you're 39 years old. And like you said, maybe it's not has nothing to do with age or anything like that, but it certainly is something you had going on for a long time that all of a sudden reared its head now, which is, you know. 39 years is still a long time for something to stay hidden like that. But So Clint, so now you've gone here, we kind of know where you're at as far as regaining your medical. You're on this waiting period and you got to do the other tests and wear the monitor and all that. So tell us how it's worked for you since you stopped working. Like, how have you been getting paid? Where's that pay coming from? Is it coming from sick or short-term disability? And when does it turn to long-term? And when does loss of license come in? Like, how's that all? I'm sure that's been a learning process because a lot of people that have all of these insurances don't know how they work until all of a sudden it's the biggest thing in your life is figuring out how it all works. So kind of run us through that process if you don't mind.
Okay. So what happened was, is when I contacted them initially and told them what was happening, the first thing they did was they told me that I had to, and this is just the way that I'm not sure how every other company works.
Sure.
And I'm not sure how a corporate operation would work. And that's kind of also another part that I want to discuss. But for me, I was lucky in the sense that I had quite a few days of sick time available, quite a few days of sick available. And I also had basically 2 years of vacation available. So initially what the company did was pay out.
You mean 2 years worth of, like, not 2 years.
No, not like, two total years. I'm sorry.
Everyone should go apply at Clint's airline because they have really good vacation there.
Yeah, that's the best vacation.
You get 2 years of vacation every year.
Whenever you need, just take a sabbatical. It's fine.
I had 2 years of accrued vacation, I guess you would say, but not, I didn't have 2 years available. I had,
right.
I think it was 6 weeks of vacation available. So they paid out all of my vacation in steps. They didn't pay it all out at once. They paid it out over a course of a couple of weeks. So basically, they were covering what they owed me as a minimum. So if you're talking in the airlines, you have a monthly minimum, and then they're covering a biweekly basis. They were paying out vacation and sick time at that, which was good because it was basically like a normal paycheck for, I don't know, close to 3 to 4 weeks after this happened. But once that ran out, then I started a 90-day clock for what's called long-term disability. And that's a negotiated part of our contract with our company. However, long-term disability checks don't kick in until 90 days after you expire all of your sick time, as well as all of your vacation time.
And that's what about short-term?
Well, that's probably the short-term is the, how do I say this? Short-term was or is not a very good benefit for the particular company that I work for. Now, saying that it's what was negotiated by my union, it is what it is. Short-term disability kicked in right away. However, for my particular circumstance, it's only $50 a week.
Oh, man.
Whoa.
And you work for one of the big three legacy carriers. Like, you're not working at some two-bit operation. Like,
no.
This is one of the big boys.
Correct. And so if we want to discuss this further, when we talk about insurance and coverage, that is really the biggest thing. And the short-term process, this 90-day window is of me not getting a paycheck. I'm basically on unpaid status with my company. That is a very difficult process and a very difficult time.
At that time, Clint, do you actually have to write a check to the company to pay your health insurance premiums?
I do. Now, that didn't kick in because, so while those, when they were paying out my vacation and my sick time,
sure,
that was still being deducted out, but I just received my first bill for my insurance just the other day. So that was my first bill from them. And I have to pay that out until my long-term disability kicks in. And then that will come out of my long-term disability paychecks.
Got it.
So if you do all the math for me, my first long-term disability paycheck. So you have the short-term disability and then it falls to long-term disability. And then remember, this is all contractual. This is all what my company and my union negotiated. This is not what you can do for yourself outside of that. And that's kind of what I want to hit home on when we talk about stuff a little bit later on. So my short-term disability contractually is basically $50 a week. My long-term kicks in 90 days after I've used all of my sick time as well as all of my vacation time. However, for my particular company, when they pay you looking back 2 weeks. So my first paycheck for long-term disability is going to be zero, because when they cut that check and they look back 2 weeks, there's not going to be anything there. So my first real check from my company that's a regular long-term disability paycheck will not actually show up until almost 130 days after I went out.
Wow.
So I'm basically on my own for 130 days.
And what's that based on, that check? Is it a percentage of your min guarantee, or what is it?
The way that they calculated it and what they agreed to was it's 60% of your average take home. However, when they look at the average take home, they look back at the last 12 months. So that can be pretty substantially different depending on what airplane you're on, what seat you're in, if you're a captain, if you're a first officer. And then, unfortunately, one of the negatives for our contract is that it has a maximum amount that they'll pay out each month. So 60% is arbitrary once you hit the maximum. And then once you hit the maximum payout, I'm actually going to be closer to 40% of what I was making, because I actually have reached the maximum, and my maximum is approximately 40% of what I was making before.
Oh, wow.
So,
yeah, those are the details that I bet you didn't know until you got to this spot, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of did, but I mean, I guess I was kind of living in a thought that, you know, maybe I was naive. I mean, it's hard to say that, but I was naive because I didn't really think that anything like this would happen to me at this age. That makes sense. Like, I understand guys that are older having problems, but then when you're older, you've also had income for longer, you have savings for longer, so you don't really worry about it as much. And then it hits you, and it's like, okay, this is my new reality, and this is what I have to deal with.
And the other thing too, Clint, I think, is that everybody's under the impression is once you get to the major airlines, you know, the big carriers, you're golden. Like, you know, you're kind of untouchable. Like, well, whatever, I'm insured. If I lose my medical, I still get paid. But nobody actually looks at the meat of the benefit and where, you know, how long you might go without getting paid. You know, and these are some of the best benefits in the industry, all the way down to some of these other lower cost carriers, and then down to the corporate guys that may not have any benefit, you know, as far as disability or loss of license and everywhere in between. And so I think even when you're at what's perceived as being some of the pilot jobs with the best benefits, you still need to know what that benefit is. And, you know, and perhaps there might be other coverage you want to get to fill in the gaps, you know?
Well, and that's, yeah. And if we're going to talk, if I'm going to be blunt with you, the bottom line is the airlines provide a pretty decent benefit, but not a great benefit. And I think that a lot of pilots, especially junior pilots who probably aren't making as much, regional pilots who aren't making as much, and especially corporate pilots, they really need to understand what they need to do to protect themselves. And I understand it can be really difficult. And that was a lot of my decision-making when I made these choices to not select a benefit or to select a benefit, was how much money am I going to lose? And yeah, but I'm not really losing money when that happens, because in the long run, if something like this happens, now I'm really losing money.
Yeah, because you're in the mindset of it's never going to happen to me, especially when you're younger, you know, and you're a new hire your first few years. And all you focus on is how much is going to reduce your paycheck, and not necessarily the potential benefit of the decisions you make at that time. And I think we all get caught up into that. I certainly am.
And one other thing you don't even consider, especially because you're, you know, relatively young, all of the juicy retirement contribution that you get from the company, you're not receiving that right now, are you?
No.
Because there's no income.
But there are coverages out there that cover that too. Like, we have that at our company. I think it's an optional benefit, but it also insures you against your loss of company contribution to your 401k. Because when you go on long-term disability, there's no company match or contribution to your 401k off of that, is there?
No, that's correct. I actually just got off the phone today with my long-term disability representative, and we were just going over the numbers. And that is correct, Max. There is no contribution to my 401k, which is a good thing if I'm on leave for a very long time, because I'm going to need pretty much every dollar I can get, and I'd rather it not be going to my 401k right now. However, that being said, it also is a loss in income to my 401k.
Well, and you run the compounding interest calculator on that, because you still have 25 years left, you know, and it's...
Yeah, it adds up. It really does.
That's supposed to be pretty substantial, so...
Yeah, so I guess if I can push anything along to anybody, is You know, obviously, if you work for one of the legacy carriers or you work for a big company and you have all these things, that's great. But it doesn't really fulfill everything that you need. And you really need to understand the fine point of it. You know, you're sitting in, let's just put someone an example like Max, you just went through NDoc class and you're getting thrown all these different things
exactly
at you every day. And it's like you have a benefits class that lasts 20 minutes and there is paperwork after paperwork. And then you have to move on and start covering something else. And that stuff is extremely important to understand exactly what you're getting. And you need to know, is that going to be enough for me and my family and our needs? Luckily for me, you know, my wife works. She has a fairly decent job. She makes pretty decent money. So, I mean, she's picking up the gap right now, and that's really helping us a lot. And then we luckily had a fair amount of money in savings, which I took another job outside of flying while I'm out for a little while. I decided to not do that anymore because it was a little bit too stressful, more stressful than flying.
Call those real jobs, Clint.
Yeah, it's a real job. this was a real job, capital R-E-A-L. You know, that did help. It did fill the gap.
That's another thing too. Don't you have to be careful? Because then if you start getting income, could that mess with your disability insurance?
Not for the first 12 months. That was something I had to confirm with my company. I also had to get a letter of approval that I could take outside employment and just...
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go. See, at least you went through the steps. So,
that was one thing, is I never made any assumptions through this whole process. I always made sure I verified and then I double verified that I was doing it the right way, because I didn't want to put myself in a scenario where, yeah, I was actually going to put myself in a situation that didn't make sense for me to do.
You're certainly in uncharted territory for yourself, and it's not you know, you can't call one of us your other buddies that have gone through this process, because none of us have. So, well, Clint, I guess at this point, going through this whole ordeal, and you're not even to the conclusion of it, but up till now, what advice would you give your fellow aviators here on what you've learned to this point?
Well, the first thing I would say is, and Dylan and I spoke about this the other day when we were talking, is never think that it can't happen to you, because mine is a health issue, and that can happen to anybody. You know, my heart problem is what it is, but you could end up with cancer. You can name the big three: heart, cancer, lungs, liver. Something bad happens to you, and that's just kind of how it goes. But you have to realize that this can happen to you, no problem. I have a friend who was getting off an airplane a few years ago who ended up taking a bad step and rolled his ankle and ended up tearing ligaments and destroying bone structure in his ankle, to the point where he has to walk with a cane and his entire career is over because he took a bad step off an airplane. Or like Dylan said, you're taking your kids to school and you get into a car accident, and maybe nothing happens to you, you know, negatively, like you don't pass away, but you end up with nerve damage and you can't use your hands and your shoulders right anymore. This career is so fickle in a way that's the first advice, is believe that it can happen to you. That's the first thing I would tell people, is believe that this kind of stuff can happen to you, because it can. From that, my advice for everyone, I don't care if you're corporate all the way to flying for the airlines, or even it doesn't matter where you are in this career, you need to know that you're covered. And I know that it can be a tough decision to make financially sometimes, where you're maybe spending so much on insurance and coverage a month and you feel like it's not worth it. It will feel like it's not worth it until it is worth it. Until that day, then it's worth it. So I would tell everyone to explore not only what the company offers them, but to look outside of the company for other insurances. And you can go with, you know, a company that specializes in aviation, like a Harvey Watt, who has lots of options for short-term disability, for long-term disability, and they have great options. But you got to look around. And the way I look at it is, my advice is, think about short-term first. You know, you break your wrist, you can't fly for whatever, call it 2 months, 3 months. What are you going to do? How are you going to be covered? Then move into like a longer period of time, 6 months to 12 months. How am I going to be covered? What do I need to do? And then look at indefinitely, because I think you have to look at it at all levels. So I would suggest to everyone to really take the time with your family or with yourself and sit down and look at, what do I need to do short term? What's going to work for me short term? What do I have available to me? I think I was talking about it earlier. Like I said, my wife works. We have some investments. We have some savings. So we can make up the 90 days. And then, you know, once long-term disability kicks in, it's still going to be very tight, but we're going to be able to get by and we're going to be fine. However, what if we go to 2 years? What if we go to 3 years? That's not going to be the case at that point. So you have to really kind of gauge it from different standpoints, and you need to cover yourself with all those standpoints. And I would say, if I could go back and say that some of the mistakes I made was, my union offers a lot of different types of insurance, and I'm covered by one of them. However, that policy doesn't kick in for 14 months after the event. So we're talking all the way to August of next year before I would even see a payout from the coverage I have. They had some short-term stuff that I didn't sign up for initially. And when I did try to sign up for it, I wasn't eligible for it because you could only sign up for the first 5 years. So sometimes dragging your feet on making these decisions is not the best idea.
Wait, so you mean you're ineligible for that insurance because you didn't opt for it during the first 5 years you worked there? So now it's gone forever?
Yeah. And I'm not going to go too into detail on that. There was some issues with that, but yes,
okay.
Essentially I could have been eligible, but there was a mistake made in my paperwork and they didn't realize that I hadn't been at the company for 5 years. But yes, some of the insurances, I'm just going to give you a quick example. ExpressJet, when I worked there, offered long-term disability that was really, really good. However, if you didn't sign up for it on day one, it changed the policy. So if you signed up for it your first day of ground school, it was covers that you could have. And we have a friend who experienced cancer, and he had luckily signed up for that long-term disability policy, and that helped him out substantially during his recovery. So again, it goes back to that whole know what you're reading and be thorough with it on day one. Yes, in my case, the short-term disability, I was told I was ineligible because I had to sign up within the first 5 years and I hadn't. Because again, I was dragging my feet because I wanted to make that extra, you know, $80 a month.
Yeah. There's so much coverage, and depending on where you at and the resources that are available to you at a big airline, you can call your union. They have a benefits guy, like a benefits representative or a committee, and you can call and they'll explain everything to you, what the company offers and what your options are. And all the way down to, if you're, you know, work for a Part 91 corporate department, I mean, you can call insurance brokers or people at companies that offer aviation type insurance and stuff and really figure it out. You just have to, I think, make sure to take the time to really understand it and really think about tailoring it to your specific situation. So.
Well, and I agree with you 100%. I think, you know, I never took the time. Again, it goes back to the old, this stuff's not going to happen to me till I'm older and I'll be fine. I really think that every pilot who's out there, you know, like I said before, this is a fickle career. It can go away in a heartbeat. And they really need to take the time and think about what they need. And yes, I should have called. I regret not calling. Like you said, the major airlines have a department that this is what they're in charge of. And I bet their phone doesn't ring that much with these kind of questions, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I highly doubt it does. I'm sure that there are some people out there that are very proactive and take care of this stuff. But then at the same time, you also kind of get lulled into a false sense of security that, oh, whatever is there is going to take care of me.
Well, hopefully, Clint, by coming on and sharing your story, I'm certain it's changed my outlook on how I look at all of that stuff and my benefits. It certainly has changed the decisions I made. And hopefully some of our listeners will take your story and use it as a reason to have some self-reflection on where they're at and where their coverages are and take a deeper look into it.
Well, I hope they do. I really do. Because I wouldn't wish what's going on with me on anybody. It's not a fun situation, but you know, I also know that I'm lucky because I have the resources to get through this period of time. I know that there's guys out there that don't, and I would never want anything like this to happen to them.
Well, the silver lining too, Clint, is that at least your condition is fixable, and you're going to be able to get your medical back ultimately. I mean, and there's a lot of people that aren't that lucky, if you can say that in this situation.
That's one of the reasons I say I'm lucky is, you know, I have a chance of getting back to work here in the next, hopefully I'll be back to work in the next 90 days. You know, we'll see how that goes. I still have to deal with the FAA and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, yeah, I have a chance to get back to work. There are people that don't. And so I really hope that everyone just kind of takes a step back and thinks, you know, what if I'm one of those people that doesn't have a chance to get back to work?
Yeah.
It's definitely sobering stuff, Clint. We certainly appreciate you sharing your story. Maybe that'll be a silver lining of this experience, is that you can be somebody that helps people realize the situation is serious and you need to give it some serious thought. I know I speak for all our listeners. We're all pulling for you and confident that you will get back flying the line soon. And we'd love to hear back from you again when you have more updates to your story. I think it'd be a really interesting process to follow. You know, just knowing you personally and following this story has been very eye-opening. And I think the thing that I walk away from this is that nothing happens fast.
No,
you know, it does not. It's like everything moves slow. And when you're waiting for that paycheck to roll in and you've got mouths to feed and everything else, that's got to be agonizing.
It is. You know what? It's funny. I'm trying to stay lighthearted about all this. I mean, I know this is kind of, like you said, it's a very eye-opening and sobering discussion. But there has been some good stuff with it. You know, I've been able to spend a lot more time with my son, which as a pilot, we all know that you don't get this opportunity very, I wouldn't call it an opportunity, but the chance. So I've been trying to, you know, make the best of it and spend time with my family and with my son and enjoy myself as much as I can. But at the same time, yeah, it's like you said, it's very eye-opening and it's very sobering to realize how bad things can get. And I'm not even in the darkest spot. I know people that are worse than me. And I really don't know how to explain it other than I have. You have to protect yourself as much as you possibly can, even if it's short term. And I just want to thank you guys for the opportunity to talk to you. And yes, I will follow up with you. It's like you said too. Yes, it's been the longest. Let's see. My surgery was on July 8th. And so I'm, what am I now? 2.5 months from that. And it has been the longest 2.5 months of my life, for sure. I'm just waiting for the 90-day mark. And then it feels like everything will kick into gear. But if you know you're secure and you're happy where you're at and you have things in a position where you feel like you can be stable, if something like this happens to you, that's really what you need to do. Even if it feels like it is a burden when you do it.
Well, you know what else is crazy, Clint? I'm pretty sure this is the most serious conversation we've ever had in the last 20 years we've known each other.
Yeah, definitely the most. Yeah, for sure.
It's kind of freaking me out. I think we have to go.
Yeah, I think probably would be a good idea. So
we need to get back to making fun of your golf swing.
Yeah.
And that kind of stuff. All right, Clint. Well, thank you so much for the time. We appreciate it. We'll check back in with you. We're all sending you positive thoughts, and we know you'll be back in the cockpit soon. Thanks for sharing your story.
Thanks, guys. Love you.
Thanks, Clint. See you, buddy.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Clint.
I hope you enjoyed Clint's story. We're going to be staying in touch with Clint as we always do and providing updates. And finally, when he does regain his medical and go back to work, just so you have a conclusion to that story.
And coming up, we've got a conversation with Dave. We did not know Dave beforehand. He reached out to us via ProPilot World to share his story. And his loss of medical journey was a little bit different because it wasn't something
very different
physical.
Yeah,
it was something more on the mental and medication side, which...
Well, and the ramifications, I think what you'll find interesting is Dave's story to leading to the loss of his medical started when he was a kid.
Yeah.
And on medication he was taking before he even considered becoming a professional pilot. So it's something that you can actually take now, might potentially change medications with your own children.
Let's get right to it. This is Dave. His screen name on ProPilot World is With Prist Please. And here we go. So welcome to the program, Dave. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Max. Thanks, Dylan. First time caller, long time listener.
First time, long time.
That's right. Love it. So Dave, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Where'd you go to school and your flying background?
Cool. Yeah. So I'm a Northeastern boy. I'm a Mass hole. I originally went to a school called formerly called Daniel Webster College, which had a small aviation program up in Nashua, New Hampshire. The program closed a couple of years ago now. Graduated in 2010, 2009 area, CFI'd up there, flight instructed in the Massachusetts, New Hampshire area at a handful of Part 61 schools and one 141 school, and did that for about 2 years. Then my friends called me and asked if I wanted to fly 135 in caravans down in the Caribbean. And of course, it was at the winter, so I was like, yeah, sure, I would rather not shovel snow anymore. And so I ended up going down with my current company. As a Part 135 caravan first officer, commonly known as a flap operator. The airplane always has training wheels. But anyways, I went down there. I lived in San Juan, Puerto Rico. And actually did that for a couple seasons, flying in and out of areas like St. Bart's. We're one of the few 135 U.S. operators that has scheduled service into the island of St. Bart's. But spent many years flying 135 and both the caravan and the PC-12, a little time in the TBM. In that process, when I was flying for my current company, I had an air traffic control application in, and one of the processes for that is a psychological evaluation, which in the review, the doctor noticed some previous diagnoses that I had disclosed to the FAA, and that person did end up writing a very good review of me, which kind of started this whole process of me unraveling and ultimately losing my medical pending release of records. I remember it was actually a little more than 4 years ago. I was actually in Westchester Airport entering a flight plan into the FMS of our citation when my father called me and said that he got a letter from the FAA saying that my medical had been denied.
Oh, wow.
So it was kind of an emotional event, actually. I remember the chief pilot happened to be also in the FBO, and I notified him like the day of and everything. So it was kind of rough. I actually happened to beat the captain to the airplane that day. He was running late, so I was doing all of his duties too. So when he showed up, I was like, yeah, I really can't finish this trip, but the plane's all set to go. So
so they denied it based on something that happened before you even started flying?
Yeah, well, the kind of a good segue into a little bit about my medical history and kind of how I ended up getting denied in the first place. I was, you know, like many kids, you know, I grew up and went through high school and grade school in the mid 90s, you know, early 2000s. And I think a lot of kids my generation, I was diagnosed with ADD in sixth grade, and I was on medications for that. It was a mild case, ironically, and me working through this process, I actually found my old lesson plans. You know, I looked through my previous paperwork from, you know, back in sixth grade, and like it's written in there that it was like a very mild case, and actually said that my parents could go either way. They could either put me on ADD meds and or do nothing. And of course, you know, it was really common back then. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And of course, we have absolutely no clue what the FAA's restrictions are. So I ended up going on medication back in sixth grade. You know, and I was on ADD meds for a while. Ended up in approaching freshman year in high school. Our family had like a really awful slew of events that included like a death in the family. One other family member was diagnosed with cancer. The family cat died. Like you can, like every single thing that you can possibly imagine happened within 6 months.
Sounds like a country song.
Jeez.
Yeah, well, not up here in the Northeast.
Right.
We wouldn't.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it had to be like about the Red Sox from like, you know, like the mid 90s to early 2000s would probably be a more appropriate thing in reference to Dirty Water or something. So of course, I'm like starting like, you know, freshman year in high school as like a nerdy kid who like builds model airplanes and all that kind of stuff. So
that wasn't stressful enough, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like tell the variations on different F-16 types and, you know, I'm working through all that. And so that led to me being diagnosed with depression. Of course, that led to meds as well. And so, you know, I went through high school. When it came down to time to decide what to do, like career-wise, my father really pushed me to fly airplanes. He, like, I was so all about airplanes. I'm playing flight sim all the time. Like, I'm doing all these aviation camps and all that kind of stuff. And he really pushed me to do it. One of the things is, as we kind of looked at colleges, is that there really wasn't any guidance out there to say, you know, what was required for a medical. And so we, you know, it was my dad reaching out to find out that, well, one, BS, like ADD can be a potentially grounding case as well as depression. And none of the medications I was on were authorized. And that was kind of like my dad kind of stumbled upon that. That's one of the things that kind of really needs to improve in this industry is, you know, people that are raising their kids and potentially making them want to be pilots need to know that when these medications come up, that they may potentially have serious ramifications on their career.
I mean, just because you're on them in your past, not necessarily after you've had a medical or were flying airplanes or anything, just because in your childhood, it can affect your medical.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, no, wow. if it's disclosed, it's kind of like the sleep apnea stuff where once it's disclosed that it kind of triggers the FAA to go into this process where you have to be tested and a bunch of other stuff. I was already weaning myself off these meds. I really honestly hadn't found that they really helped me anyways. And matter of fact, it was kind of working with a therapist over time to realize that the quote unquote depression I was really having was actually more of what's called an adjustment disorder, which is simply a normal reaction from induced stress from family, like life events. And ironically, and we can talk about this later, but ironically, he says it's actually more terrifying if you don't react to those things
right.
in that way.
Yeah.
It's actually way more abnormal and usually a poor sign that you don't handle stress that well. But I got myself off these meds. I got myself all off meds and everything. And then I went to college. At that point, I got a standard issuance student pilot certificate, and I went through, you know, 141 training program, Danny Webster College, just like a lot of other people did, and didn't have any problems going through all that stuff. And, you know, I held a medical for close to 10 years, normal issuance, never on meds, you know, no interest in going back to meds. I found that they didn't do anything for me. And of course, went for the air traffic control application, where it kind of like pulled all this information out. And this one person who I was being interviewed down in Puerto Rico for an air traffic control position kind of just wrote some really nasty things about me, said that I wasn't clear of my depression, that ADD might have signs of ADD in some ways. And that kind of led through a couple of other additional events, lost the spiral to me losing my medical again. And that was, again, 4 years ago. That actually put me back into a depression, understandably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those things where I had like all these learning, like, you know, ADD is a learning disability that I have been working through for my entire life. It'll all be mild. And it's one of those things that like feels like a monkey on your back where you're like, oh, well, there's no way you can get your private pilot because you have ADD. And you're like, well, there's no way you're going to get through your instrument because you have ADD. And then you're like, I'm never going to get my commercial. You kind of see where I'm going there.
Mm-hmm.
And like for the FAA to be like, well, guess what? Now you aren't going to fly anymore because of it. It's kind of a big slap in the face.
Especially because you'd had it for 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, especially in like the going down the air traffic control realm too, like I was really excited about it. I had friends, the facility that I'd been selected for, I had a lot of friends there and they were so excited to have me working there. And, it was a huge slap in the face. You know, I'm really fortunate. I had a lot of people supporting me and I'm very fortunate in the fact that I had a mentor who, used to be a pilot. He was a Delta pilot for many, many years. And he actually lost his medical post 9/11 and he lost it permanently. And he ended up having to change careers. And, he was kind of already a mentor and he was like the first person I called when I lost my medical. And I honestly, like, I don't think I would ever fought through it if it wasn't for him. So you know, that's kind of like what left me losing my medical, you know, in the past. And ever since then, you know, there's a lot of things that kind of led me to working through it. One of the things is that that day I lost my medical, the president of my current operation, you know, called me and he actually brought me into his office and said, I always have a place here.
That's cool.
Which was like, you know, it kind of, you know, it was like literally the day of. Like, I think like I learned, you know, like 10 o'clock, I learned that I lost my medical and like around like noon, I was being told by all the managers of my company that like, you're not going anywhere. Like you're still going to work here.
That's really cool. Wait, Dave. So I have a couple of questions leading up to this point.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
So when they send you that letter, does it tell you why specifically that they're denying your medical?
It does. Yeah, no, they made specific references to certain doctor's visits. And it is outlined specifically, why it's being denied. And okay. it's very official and formal.
And then, so were they denying it on the basis of like not previously reporting medications you are on in your childhood, or based on the diagnosis of the medical examiner that for the air traffic control position, or what was the real nail in the coffin, or the basis of the whole denial?
Well, I think the nail in the coffin was like a combination of like probably like 10 to 12 nails. I think it was a culmination of things. I think there's things from some things that the evaluator discovered that they believed was a serious problem when they really weren't. There's also some mess ups in my FAA medical file. There was a weird mess up where the first AME that I ever saw didn't file that I disclosed my ADD in the correct box. And so it made it look like I had never disclosed my ADD period. It made it look like I was hiding it in accordance to the computer system. So that was like one of the other things that kind of led to it. It was kind of a culmination of things where the FAA was like, you know what, we need further information here. There were some other things where like a regional flight surgeon also failed to make me go for certain tests back in 2005 when I originally applied for one as well. So there's a whole bunch of things that kind of led to me losing it. And some of it, honestly, I'm not going to lie, some of it was my fault. And it seemed like some of it was actually the bureaucracy's fault as well.
So when you got the notification from the FAA and you said the letter came to your dad, was there information on, were you able to make an appeal at that time? Was there any type of review, or was it just black and white? Hey, we're suspending your medical.
It outlaid, because it was via the regional flight surgeon, it outlined what would need to be done for me to get it back. And it was honestly, the instructions were very clear. The one thing I think at that time, at this point, it had been like close to a year and a half or so since I had been kind of like working through this process. Like my application with air traffic control had been suspended because of this. And I think like I was about a year and a half into fighting this that I didn't have it in myself. I think some of the things that they needed and required me to do was to sit in front of a neuropsychological and do another neuropsychological evaluation. And there's a lot of things that kind of led to me not doing that. At least right at that time. Part of it was the fact that I was holding a piece of paper that grounded me.
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, the FAA did outline why I was grounded and explained what needed to be potentially done to fix it. I just didn't have it in myself to try to climb up that ladder anymore. And it was also, you know, also paying out of pocket.
Yeah. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of work, especially if you don't have an advocate or somebody that is, you know, assisting you, but to take that on yourself, I imagine. Yeah.
So you had to pay the doctors for the evals and everything out of your pocket, right? It wasn't insurance.
Yeah. No, so I took some time off and kind of like assessed myself, you know, try to figure out how I felt about the whole thing in general. You know, I think one of the things I needed to do was come to terms with the fact that there is a very strong possibility that I'll never touch an airplane ever again, at least to be, especially in some sort of method to generate revenue or, you know, make money. And I think that was one of the things I needed to swallow that pill because it was something I just couldn't believe, you know. And then I kind of just settled. I was fortunate to become a ground instructor for my current company. That led to me kind of being promoted over time. I just took advantage of the Monday through Friday 9-to-5 schedule. Actually got vacation requests approved really quickly.
What?
Yeah, I know. We're crazy, right? You know, I spent a couple of years connecting with friends, family. I traveled a lot. You know, I also picked up a lot of hobbies that I remember really couldn't do on a 135 schedule. About 2 years after being grounded, I had a friend that went through a very similar problem, and he recommended a therapist that worked with him through his medical loss and his, like, a lot of his stuff. Got in touch with that therapist, and he ended up being extremely helpful. And I spent about a year paying out of pocket to meet this guy and really kind of, you know, work through the issues I'd had, my diagnoses. And I outlined to him that I really wanted to work towards potentially doing another FAA neuropsychological evaluation. You know, I kind of learned these things that, like, there's no reason for me to be so defensive about my feelings. You know, I learned that a lot of my feelings I had were very normal. You know, especially for the medical and career losses. And that led to me, you know, once I worked through that, I worked with an organization that I strongly recommend called Aerospace Medicine Advisory Service, or AMAS, as well as a gentleman called named Bruce Chen, Dr. Chen, in Illinois, to kind of outline everything that happened to me and touch base with them to kind of figure out what needed to be done for me to get back flying. And that required a lot of neuropsychological evaluations.
Gotcha. So that began your process of getting back into the cockpit. Was there like a single thing that made you decide that, hey, I want to go get my medical back? Or was it just kind of the building and the growth?
It was one of those, you know, not to be cliche, but it was one of those things, you know, like you have shower thoughts. And I remember spending almost every morning being like, you know, is this something I really want to do? And I'm like, I need to see this completion. Like, I think that was one of the things in my head. And I spent a lot of time thinking about maybe I should change careers, maybe I should do this or do that. And I just kept on coming back to, I need to start flying again. I think one of the things that really kind of helped me was the fact that I was still working for an airline, you know, still, you know, part of the hiring process and being surrounded by it and being reminded that I'm not doing any of the actual flying parts of it. And the other thing too, is I was being pestered by every single person I knew professionally and personally to do it. I think there's one friend in particular who was like, you know what, you're just not going to do it. I just know you don't have it in you. And I was like, okay, all right. That was like, he was the one to be like, all right, I'm going to show you. Like, I'm not going to mess around anymore. And, that was kind of the thing that kind of
little reverse psychology.
Yeah,
huh?
Exactly. I use that same technique with my kids.
I guess it works with adults too. I think after doing therapy for a year, you know, I felt good enough to do the psych evals, and like these are evals that are colossally expensive. I mean, I don't want to put a number on it, but I'll just say that like you could easily afford an additional rating for some of these things.
Wow.
It was a lot. I had to save a lot of money. I ended up using some money that I had spared, you know, kind of like emergency funds that were kind of backups to pay for these evaluations. But, you know, I kind of prepared for them. And there's a lot of, unfortunately, there's a lot of information out there. I happen to have a lot of friends that are in the psych field that could kind of help me give an idea of what the evaluations were on. You know, I did things like Lumosity, mental math, and ironically, playing video games was actually one of the kind of the more helpful things to work on. So the more tighter social skills, I was going to bars and talking to strangers to kind of improve my ability to talk to, you know, just kind of just talk in general. That was an interesting step.
That sounds like a normal Friday night for Max.
Easy.
So it sounds like, the mental determination to do that, it was pretty significant that you really had to put your mind to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, it's probably the wise choice to wait till you're in the right place instead of trying to rush it before you do all this stuff. Otherwise, it's you know, the odds of it turning out favorably are much less.
Right, exactly. I think that, and a lot of it has a lot to play with it. I think one of the things I've learned over through these phases that's kind of a misnomer when it comes to mental health is that someone's mental health is very fluid, depending on the events that are happening in their lives and everything like that. When I think a lot of people kind of view mental health as just sort of like a static thing. You know, I think we all go through events in our lives that kind of change how we feel and do that. And I think that's kind of a false mindset is that we're very, very static, and that's not the case.
You know, one thing that Max and I have been discussing a little bit that's kind of the intersection of mental and physical health is sleep. And did that ever come into play with you?
It did. And one of the things was that when I was working through with my therapist, he kind of discovered that I was having issues with my sleep, which kind of ultimately led to me taking a sleep study, which turned out like the most mild sleep apnea you could ever possibly imagine. I think it was like literally like within like half a percentage of the FAA, like legal definition of sleep apnea.
Oh my gosh.
And so it was light enough where my sleep doctor was like, he said, you don't have to go on a CPAP if you don't want to. And I was like, listen, I need to, like, I will either have to go on a CPAP or I need to figure out a way to do it. Cause the FAA isn't so keen about weight loss. And so what I did was I asked AMAS and asked if weight loss was an option. Like, well, if you're as mild as you say, it probably is. And so I I went a little aggressive and I lost 50 pounds.
Whoa.
You know, and worked. Yeah. I went to the gym a lot, you know, added a C to the thickness and really kind of worked through losing a lot of weight. And that ended up reversing the sleep diagnosis. You know, if you're listening and you're looking to try to figure out how to lose weight, the FAA's program works really well.
Oh, they have an actual published program?
No,
I'm just kidding.
I was going to say, what? We'll be selling Dave's weight loss secrets on our website. You can visit.
I just Googled FA weight loss program. Nothing came back.
Yeah. Yeah. So that I always tell people, they're like, wow, it's so great that you lost that weight. I'm like, yeah, well, you have the federal government breathing down your neck. Works really well.
Fear is an impressive motivator, right?
Yeah. And so, once I did all that, and I mean, I got the packet submitted. One of the things that AMAS did that really helped was they recommended some neuropsych guys in the United States that were really, really amazing. And they kind of pushed me in the right direction to find the doctors that would really kind of take my whole packet and submit it to the FAA via special issuance. And it was actually once everything was gathered and I knew I had the right people and I, you know, had the money for it, it was actually pretty straightforward. And, you know, everything was submitted the beginning of this year in May, and I got my special issuance 2 weeks ago.
Woohoo. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's an awesome story.
That must have been a very rewarding trip to the mailbox, huh?
Oh, yeah. No, well, it's a classic government kind of thing. Like, I've been calling them once every couple of weeks to find out where it stood, because I hadn't heard anything. And I got the lady reached out and she's like, oh, it's in the mail. I'm like, what's in the mail? She's like, your medical's in the mail. Are you real? Are you serious? I totally didn't believe her until it was in my hand.
Huh. So that an actual medical arrives in the mail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. So Oh, okay. Interesting. Guess I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I think it's actually like the process for a special issuance, it goes through, at least for the psychological evaluations, it goes through multiple sets of hands. In my case, it went through DC first, and then it went through Oklahoma. And it was the folks at Oklahoma that signed it. It entirely skipped the regional flight surgeon offices, which is exactly what my doctor said we should do. Because he said the regional offices usually have no idea when it comes to these special cases.
Huh.
That's a really awesome ending to what could be a very scary situation.
So are you going to start flying again now? Like right away? Or what's the plan?
Because I'm already current in ground school, because I've been teaching it for the past 4 years. I finished up my recurrent flight training in the airplane this last weekend, and my checkride scheduled for next week.
Nice. You going back in the CJ3?
I'm going to be in the PC-12 for now. I think my company kind of needs me in my current position. And I kind of want to slow roll it. I mean, I've knocked off quite a bit of rust, on that first bounce landing. Back in. It was very humbling to see the flight instructor grab for the controls momentarily again. That kind of brought me back, but I'm hoping to ease myself into it. But it's the first flight was kind of nerve wracking. The second flight, I remember from the last recording you guys did, the PC-12 is such an amazing airplane that I didn't really kind of realize how much I missed the thing until I jumped into it and started flying it around.
I've only have a couple hours in it, but it's just so simple and amazing. Like Jared said in our last show, if he won the lottery, that's the airplane he'd get. I'd probably do the same. You have a little bit of time in there, don't you, Max?
Yeah, it's like 20 hours in one. It's great. From what I remember, it's been a while, but that has got to be the easiest airplane in the world to land. It's got these huge like trailing link landing gear. And I mean, you have to really drop it in from high to make a poor landing.
Challenge accepted.
The nice thing is the flaps at 40 brings the nose way down, so it gives you great visibility. But I will say that because of the interlink, the tiny tail it's got, it is kind of a monster in a crosswind. I think it took a while to figure out what to do with it when landing at St. Bart's.
Oh, yeah.
I bet.
So if any of our listeners don't know about St. Bart's, we'll post a YouTube video. I'm sure you've got a bunch you could send us, Dave, of some good crashes there. But that's pretty entertaining to watch. As I say, how long is it? Like 1,500 feet or something?
Yeah, it's 2,100 and change. The glide slope for runway 10 over the hill, it's a 10-degree glide path. And then if you're approaching, so usually you use 10 that comes right over the hill through the notch when the winds are out of the east, which they normally are. But if the winds are calm or if they're out of the north, south, or west, we'll do the 2-8 approach over the beach, which are left or right 2-8 approaches. And there's actually a certain particular point inside when you're inside the bay where you cannot do a go around because you will hit the hill on the other side.
You're committed.
Huh. Yeah.
So going through this huge experience, looking back, obviously hindsight's 2020, what are some of the reflections you have about going through this? How would you advise somebody that was going to a similar situation? What are your thoughts on what could have been done differently?
Well, I think the key thing to remember, and this is one of the things that my mentor told me, which I thought was really important, which is there's a world outside the cockpit and that your health has to come first. And that regardless of what the FAA standards are, you know, you have to take care of yourself first. And, you know, there's a lot of people in this world that make do not being a pilot. And I think that's something that it's really easy to lose sight of when you're perpetually surrounded by pilots and surrounded by airplanes. And it just sucks up all so much of our lives when we're flying that we don't really realize that there is actually a life outside of there. And there's a lot of the things, you know, a lot of the excitement and things that we really enjoy with aviation and airplanes, you can find in other avenues that actually give you time off and actually allow you to be home for, like, you know, Thanksgiving and Christmas. So I think that was a key thing to kind of suck up. I think that the other thing that I really wish I had listened to for a long time is that if anyone ever goes through this, is you cannot listen to the naysayers. You cannot listen to the people that tell you that, you know, FDFAA, this whole process is BS, these doctors don't know you, that because it is a very frustrating process. And there's a lot of people that chimed in and told me that what is happening to me. These are be personally friends or family members that told me what this is going through is total BS and that it's unacceptable and all those things. And that was all advice that got to my head. And one of the things I didn't, you know, it took me a while to realize and recognize is that, yeah, the process is difficult and you are dealing with bureaucracy, but guess what? Outside of illegally taking an airplane, it's the only way to get cleared. It's the only way to really get flying. You really have no other options. I think some people talked about, well, you should sue the FAA. I'm like, yeah, if you want to talk about pockets of money, I do not have those. And so that was a thing that, like, I, you know, hindsight, I probably would have gotten my medical years ago if I just ignored that advice. And that's advice I solicit to both people that either lose their medical or people that know people that have lost their medical, is just to not be a naysayer through the process and be more supportive. I think another thing too, when this is more of an emotional level, mental health kind of thing, is to find someone you can be honest with about your feelings that's not a friend or family member. I think a lot of times the FAA, you know, the FAA has changed their opinions on mental health a lot recently, which has been great. But I think there's one of the fallacies is using a friend or family member almost as a therapist. And what happens is you end up losing, instead of having a friend or a family member, they end up becoming a therapist. And I think everyone knows someone who ends up pretending like their friend or family member is a therapist, and it affects your relationship with that person. And you end up losing a friend or family member in the process, you know. The other thing too is the FAA allows, you know, a therapist is okay in certain circumstances. The other thing too is religious leaders and mentors are also things that the FAA, you don't even have to write those on a medical if you're kind of concerned about it. You know, one of the things that I'm not the religious type, but, you know, I actually did talk to certain religious leaders that were willing to talk to me, even though I wasn't part of their entity, to help me kind of be supportive through this process. So those are things that I kind of wished through. And then, of course, their personal health must come first. The next thing I would say is don't lie to the FAA. I mean, you know, there are ways to disclose. Don't disclose without first talking to professionals, but don't try to cover things up, I think, are a big thing. Like, one of the things was AMAS and you know, I used AMAS a lot, and I also used Dr. Chen at the same time, and I kind of used them to cross-check each other to see if they both kind of were in agreement. But, you know, I think one of the things I did was I found, and I didn't have this before, is it was nice to have people that were never going to sign any paperwork for me to get their unbiased opinion on what I should do with these things. Because there's a lot of ways to disclose without causing colossal amounts of red tape. And a matter of that's just trying to find the right person and running ideas off of people. Because I'm not gonna lie, when I submitted my medical for the first time, you know, the beginning of this year, I did so in complete comfort, knowing that everything that was there was totally there and that nothing was hidden. And it was actually very comforting to receive it and know that nothing is at risk and that everything, you know, that I didn't risk hiding anything and that it was, you know, I could sleep well at night. And of course, the classic things like never take your medical for granted. One of the things is always cross check and ask everyone and talk to everyone and cross check all the information that you're ever been told.
Yeah, I think it's like you mentioned, the FAA is taking a new angle on mental health, and we've seen it even in popular culture. Like recently, a lot of NBA players have come out and talked about depression and other things, and it's becoming a more openly discussed subject, I think. And I think that's really healthy. And I think maybe the FAA is in a way taken the first step with doing a lot of the like sleep and rest regulations. And yeah. So hopefully they continue to approach this and say, look, mental health issues, everybody, you know, like you said, there's different phases of your life and things happen. And it's likely that everybody at some point in their career are going to have some type of issue or situation where they're going to need some help. And so I think shining light on that topic is going to be great for our entire industry and in helping guys stay in the cockpit.
Yeah, I think something Dave said too that was really interesting is that mental health is such a fluid thing. So your mental health one week could be completely different than the next week, depending on life circumstances and what's, you know, happening at that time. And so I hopefully they take a better approach to that, you know, in managing mental health that way versus, you know, relating it exactly to physical health, where if, you know, your blood pressure is high or whatever, you know, it's doesn't necessarily isn't quite as fluid. So yeah. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's well, you also hit one of the things, which is it's, you know, the FAA is kind of in, and I'm, you know, I support, I mean, like one of the things is that I realize and recognize the fact that the FAA should be screening for neuropsychological things. There are certain diagnoses that should be grounding. There are, you know, also extreme cases, but the problem with mental health is that there's a lot of ambiguity in a lot of these circumstances. And you read through the regs, and the regs are obviously very vaguely written, so it kind of leaves them the option to decide. But I think a lot of it has to do with going through and doing research and finding out that majority of the cases people do end up with medicals in the end, and they work through it. And even when people have been denied, they end up getting worked through in the system, you know, down the road. And you know, one of the things when I told my whole story to these neuropsych guys, a lot of them were like, I would tell them the whole story of like this, that happened, my family, all that kind of stuff. And they're like, that's it. You have anything else? They're kind of like, it's kind of a mild case. And one of the things I'd never felt like, and I was going through it, especially when you're reading all these official FAA documents about how, you know, I have this issue or that issue, it's terrifying. And then you sit and you realize that, oh, well, a lot of this is actually much more mild than I thought it would be. Another thing too, one person told me was that, you know, if you end up doing these evaluations, is that these evaluators really actually do want to get you flying. And they're actually actively trying to assist you through the process. And I got that vibe with the folks I saw, both the guy I saw out in LA, and the guy that I saw closer to home and my HIMS AME. Like, I just get the vibe that they really do want to help me and they want to assist, and they're not the enemy in going through this process.
One more question on the AMAS services. Is that a service that you pay for through a membership, or how exactly do you get service from them?
So if you go on the AMAS website, what you can do is they can offer a consultation for 10 days. You pay a flat fee. I believe it's changed over the years. I think it's something like $50, $60. It's no more than the cost of dinner somewhere. And what you can do is you can write out your case and everything that's happening to you and send an email out, and it goes to their doctors. And then they'll do is it's completely confidential. They give you their opinion on what to do in that. And you kind of have 10 days to kind of go back and forth. You can call them and just sort of ask them what they think you should do in your case. They have much more professional services too. Like they can actually like build a packet of information for your medical and submit it. In my case, they kind of felt that wouldn't be necessary because my case was pretty straightforward. They've been absolutely invaluable. And they're one of those organizations that if someone asks about a medical problem, I promptly tell them, like, go to AMS, write out exactly, do not lie, and tell them exactly what's happening to you and ask for their feedback, because they recommended the doctors they recommended to me end up being the real thing that kind of led to me getting my medical back so quickly once I decided to get the ball rolling.
Money well spent, sounds like.
Absolutely.
So what are your thoughts going forward as far as helping the industry with the mental health issue and people that could be in a similar situation?
I think one of the things that, you know, I think we already kind of touched base with this too, is that, you know, there, I think there is still a little bit of a stigma out there. I think it very much is changing. I think it's, as you guys pointed out, I think it's the whole nation is changing their opinion on it. The stigma is still there. I remember I've gone out with people and I have friends that were pilots when I was going to seek therapy. And they're like, are you sure you want to go seek a therapist? And by the way, do you want to do a shot with me? And like, that's the kind of things that you would see all the time, is like, we'd much rather, yeah, as a community, potentially self-medicate with alcohol than potentially sit down and talk to someone about our quote unquote feelings. So I think that problem exists. And I think we're not the only industry that has those issues. I think another thing too, that kind of gets blanketed, is the fact that, you know, these big events like German Wings, Egypt Air, FedEx, Malaysian, you know, these are awful events that happen, and they kind of stick out in people's mindset. But the true crime is those pilots that do harm to themselves or just completely suffer in silence, and, you know, will never do the awful things that those people potentially did, and are just simply flying with and just feeling awful. I always wished there was more information to find out, you know, the pilots that, you know, commit suicide on their own. You know, there's no information out on that. And that is the true crime. And that is the true sadness in how we approach mental health in this industry.
Yeah. The sad thing is that you're actually discouraged from seeking help because of the fear of losing your medical or of having to disclose and all of that stuff. And so to your point, you have to wonder how many guys are out there that are just untreated because they're too afraid or think it's going to make, you know, them lose the medical or whatever. And there's no even, there are certain avenues, like AMS and stuff, where you can go and ask the question at least without a duty to disclose to the FAA. If you're like, hey, here's, but I think a lot of people just don't know that's available.
Yeah.
And that's probably a huge problem also.
Well, I think, and the other thing too, is that there's especially when it comes to things like potentially you have like depression, is there's a lot of, so especially to the public, there's a lot of methods to resolve depression. You know, obviously antidepressants are one thing, and the FAA does allow antidepressants with quite a bit of monitoring, but it is possible, and there are quite a few people out there that do it. You know, one of the things that really helped me, and I don't do it right now, not anymore really, is therapy is really helpful for a lot of people. And I don't think I would be where I am if it wasn't for the help of therapists that I've used. But, you know, it's even small things like, you know, exercise and being active or being social are also ways to potentially relieve these issues. So I think that it's tough, especially for, you know, almost looking back on it, it's almost fortunate that I did get diagnosed with these things, because I can't even imagine not going through my entire life to think that I didn't have any problems or that I wasn't even capable or willing to talk to another person about, you know, the issues that I've had in my life, because I think everyone kind of goes through those phases, and especially those that haven't been diagnosed. And the aviation, as you said, you know, aviation doesn't make it any easier in some cases.
Sure. Well, man, I have to commend you. That takes a lot of courage to sit here with us and tell your whole story and be open and honest like that about, you know, what happened and where you started and where you came. And I guess I'm just glad it's a happy ending of the story. I mean, at the end of the day, you showed people that, you know, while you can have a devastating thing like losing your medical, you know, sort of unexpectedly, right? Making decisions you had no idea that were going to affect you down the road. But through perseverance and making some smart moves, you're able to get it back and you're getting back to flying. And hopefully your experience not only, you know, brought you back to flying, but will help some of our listeners out there or people that have, you know, similar issues or something parallel, at least that will prevent them from losing medical or, you know, motivate them to get it back.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I mean, the other thing, you know, like any good 80s or 90s movie, you know, everyone likes a good comeback, you know, especially American.
So if we have any listeners, would you be willing to talk to anyone if they're going through a similar situation? Could our listeners reach out to you?
I would absolutely have no issues talking to anyone. On ProPilot World, my name is With Prist, Please. That's the name I kind of pick up with. I was going to either do that or No Blue Juice, but figured With Prist would be a little bit better.
Ooh, I have a good one. No DEF, please.
Oh, yeah. That's given things of late, right?
And, you know, I think a lot of folks, especially the airline folks, from what I gather, and I'm kind of working through, you know, some fact-finding for myself, but a lot of airlines commonly have support groups. But one of the things that kind of realize is that, you know, at least like, you know, anonymous phone calls or something like that, is that the 91-135 folks don't. So I've actually kind of been brainstorming an idea of doing something similar to what the ACSF does for mental health, which is to offer some sort of program, maybe even through MBAA, to allow 135 or 91 pilots to have anonymous phone calls or anonymous number to call when they have anything that they would want to run by someone else in their industry.
Yeah, I think that's really smart. A lot of the airlines are usually through the unions have aeromedical advisory and like all these tons of resources. And it's certainly an economy of scale thing. You know, when you have 10,000 pilots all or more putting, you know, a portion of their paycheck in, it supports those things. But for 91-135 guys, you are truly on your own. I mean, Dylan and I have witnessed people that have just, you know, lost their medical and probably don't have hopes of getting it back. And they didn't have insurance. There was no advisory or support for any of that stuff.
Or they didn't know where to look for it.
Or they didn't even at least know where to look. And so that's kind of what we're trying to uncover. And we're going to be going through some stuff that has to do with medicals, people telling their story like yourself, and then talking to some of the support people or advisory people. And so just to kind of get the word out, the people, there's options. You know, you can insure against this. There's places to turn. If you go to a doctor and you have something done, it's probably wise to run it past somebody before you disclose to your AME to see, you know, and the method of which to disclose it and all that stuff. So
as Max said, we really commend you for coming on and sharing your story. I think it could really be helpful to a lot of people listening out there.
Well, and I appreciate it. I mean, it's worth mentioning that I released it into the wild and kind of made a post about it. I got I got so many messages from people privately, as well as friends being like, I've gone through these things. I've done this. I've had issues before and I've had these things happen to me in the industry. And I know what you're going through and it's awesome that you are willing to push through it this far to get through it. And so I think you don't, because a little bit of that stigma is that I think people just don't feel like there are other people out there that are going through the same things they are going through. And I think that's a big part of it, is if we just don't bring it out into the open because everyone's kind of scared to talk about it. And that's one of the things I kind of realized over the time as I worked through it, is that it's far more common than people think. You know, it's just no one wants to talk about the elephant in the room.
So Dave, you said you spent a lot of time down in the Caribbean and you sent us an awesome list for San Juan, Puerto Rico, for a destination guide. Can you talk a little bit about why you like San Juan and some of your favorite places you've checked out there?
Oh, absolutely. In my time down in Puerto Rico, I probably spent close to solid 2 years, you know, month, 6 months on, 6 months off, living in the city of San Juan, and really got access to the whole island. And it's one of the best things. You know, I kind of sidelined my professional airline pilot career to kind of explore the Caribbean and live down there. And it was life-changing. And honestly, I always say that I wouldn't want to go down there again, but I would never change the time that I had down there for a life ever. I think one of my favorite things down there is that it's Puerto Rico. You know, the primary language down in Puerto Rico is really Spanish. You can get around no problem with English, but it does give a very different vibe. But at the same time, what a lot of people don't realize is you truly have all the amenities that you would have in the United States. So there's Walmart, there's Costco down there. I believe there's CVS's and Walgreens and everything. So it truly is it's an easier city to get around. Or at least the island is easier to get around than people give credit. In regards to like flying in there, I mean, San Juan Airport is effectively, you know, especially San Juan International is very simple, 2-runway setup. You know, you want to be careful with confusing Isla Grande with San Juan because they're kind of on the same lineup. Customs is pretty straightforward. In regards to where to stay, the two places people usually stay is this place called Isla Verde, which is right next to Luis Munoz International Airport, which has a lot of the hotels as well as the casinos, consolidated hotel casinos. And the other is the city of Condado, which kind of sits right in between San Juan and in Isla Grande Airport, which is also a popular airport for 91-135 folks to go. Of the places, Isla Verde is more touristy. Condado is more, they're both very touristy, but if I were to live down there, I'd absolutely live in Condado. It's just an awesome spot. There's a lot of places to eat in Isla Verde and Condado. One of the places I recommend, the couple places I recommend in Isla Verde, one is El Embique Beach Lounge. And anyone that's an airline pilot that flies in there will know what I'm talking about. It's a beach restaurant / bar that's walking distance from pretty much all the hotels in Isla Verde. And a lot of the airlines, if you don't already know, most of the airlines have some sort of discount there or something similar. Get the ahi tuna tacos. The ahi tuna wraps are absolutely wild. At least they were when I was there a couple of years ago. They also have like a really good, what's called mafungo, which is the local dish, which is effectively just mashed plantains put into a giant bowl.
I've had that before. Yeah. That's a fun one to try when you're there. What about getting out and seeing any of the island itself? Is there any cool spots to visit?
Yeah, well, I think the classic, you always got the beaches. There's Isla Verde Beach is a really good one, as well as the Pine Grove Beach in Condado. Old San Juan is a really cool place to go, and it's a short Uber ride from either Condado or Isla Verde, which is Old San Juan's it's one of the cities that's kind of surrounded by a stone wall that was originally built by the Spanish. There's a couple forts that you can explore, El Moro, Paseo del Moro, and there's a bunch of good spots down there. There's a particular walk that I like going on that I nicknamed Kitty City, because there's tons and tons of cats just kind of hang out down there. My favorite bar I've ever been to is called La Factoria, which is in Old San Juan. It's especially on like the weekends, it turns like one bar turns into 8 bars, and it's got a little bit of something for everybody. It's one of the places I always take people.
San Juan, it's crazy walking around there. It almost feels like you're in a European city. It's a very weird feeling.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, no, the between the various hills and the different colors of the buildings, mm-hmm. It's a really cool spot. If you have a really long stay, or if you're going on vacation with family, the islands of Yeques and Culebra are like really cool to visit. The beach in Culebra, Flamenco Beach, is considered to be one of the best beaches in the world. And I would agree with that.
Well, we will post all of your spots. You sent us quite an impressive list here. We'll do the destination guide via Google Maps that we've done for some of our other cities. That'll all be up on the website as well as in the show notes for the podcast. Now, Dave, you know we like to wrap up every episode with a tale from the road. Do you have a good story for us?
You've got to have a good story from all that Caribbean flying.
Oh, I do. Actually, this story is actually about flying up in the Northeast.
Okay.
Yeah, so I had just become, I was maybe a couple months into being a new captain in the PC-12. We had a charter from airport in Connecticut to kind of a podunk airport in Maine for a really big fair that happens there during the fall. And my co-pilot, Greg, was a great guy. Him and I became really good friends down in the Caribbean. And we had like a quick, it was a quick trip. It was a morning trip out. They're going to spend the day at the fair and then we're bringing them back in the late afternoon. Greg and I had great layovers all the time. And the layover on its own is a great story involving a crew car that was a pink Jeep Wrangler that I took off-roading. That's like an own story on its own. But while we're waiting for the passengers, I jokingly asked him, how much do you want to bet they're going to bring some massive award-winning pumpkin and try to jam it into the PC-12? And him and I were laughing about it. And sure enough, they showed up and they had four containers with rabbits in them. And they had a caged potbelly pig. And we both looked at it and we're like, I'm not sure how we're going to fit this in the airplane. And we put the pig in first. Loading the PC-12 is a practice in playing Tetris. And we got the pig in first, and then we got the rabbits in, and we're putting the bags on top of the pig. And I mean, the plane, the second we closed the door and started the airplane, the plane smelled like an episode of Letterkenny. Like it was, it was so smelly and smelled like a total barn.
Oh my God. And you don't have an APU or anything to like get a ton of fresh air in there, right?
Oh no, no. Yeah, there's no, it's, you know, we have the pressurization and everything like that, but it's trying the best it can, but you know, greatest smell of ammonia. So we, the weather's not great in Connecticut, and I'm looking at our destination now. I'm looking at it's, I'm like, oh great, it's down to minimums. And you know, I'm a fairly new captain. I'm trying to save gas, which means that I'm like tight on fuel. Like I'm looking at it and I'm realizing, you know, I'm gonna have to shoot the approach. If we go missed, we're going straight to the alternate and we're not messing around kind of thing, like legal, but calling it quits. Like I should have brought a little more gas. And I remember flying now, like Greg and I like get along really well. And I just go silent on the way down because I'm getting a little nervous. And he's like, are you okay over there, buddy? we're approaching our destination and we're right outside the final approach fix. And the pig takes a colossal dump. And you can just smell it permeating through the entire plane. And I remember I asked Greg, I'm like, all right, before landing checks, and he goes, landing gear down three. Oh, good Lord. Oh, geez. And him and I are just trying to stick together on the approach. Like we're missing approach call outs. And like, I was right about short, like breaking out of minimums when I was about to throw up in my mouth when we broke out of the clouds and saw the pappies in sight. And you know, landed the passengers, of course, didn't say a thing. And him and I grounded the airplane right after that for smelling like awful.
Oh my gosh. Oh,
and did you have to unload the cage too?
Oh yeah, no, we did. Yeah, it was everywhere.
That's incredible.
In the plane?
No, fortunately it was restricted to the cage, fortunately.
Okay.
So once we got it out of the airplane, it wasn't a big deal, but yeah, it did smell like Animal Farm. Absolutely.
Wow. That is quite a tale from the road.
Yeah. Gee,
well, Dave, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. We really appreciate it. Of course, we can find you on ProPilot World. Your screen name is With Pris Please. And we look forward to getting you back in the skies and seeing you airborne again. And hopefully this can be useful to other pilots as well, listening out there, that there is hope and services available for them. So thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Dave. We really appreciate it, man.
Thank you, guys.
Well, that does it for our first episode of our couple-part series here on loss of medical. I hope you guys learned as much as Dylan and I did from these guys' stories, and we certainly thank them for being so candid and giving us all the details of something that sometimes can be pretty tough to talk about.
Yeah, it takes some guts to come on and share your story, but I think both of them really realized it was important because the experiences they've gone through, they want to share it with the group, and so that we can all be aware of not only the threats that are there for your license, but also the services that are available. So speaking of services that are available, in the next episode, we're going to be bringing you an interview from our friends over at Harvey Watt, the pilot insurance company. They provide the loss of license, loss of medical insurance to the vast majority of all of the airlines and corporate and individual professional pilots. So we're going to talk to them a little bit about the services they provide, what what you have access to, what coverages you get from your airline and your union now, and then the things that you can supplement. So it's a fascinating conversation. So look for that coming up on our next episode.
Once again, as always, thanks for downloading and checking in with us here.
We appreciate your time. Thanks for sticking with us. We know this was a long episode, but it was an important topic to cover. So until next episode, remember, flexibility is the key to air power.
And also maintaining a level of fitness so you don't lose your medical. See you guys next time.
Later.